beings have to become fully enlightened. This is an inseparable part of our mind, and awareness of it gives us a firm foundation for self-confidence and hope. Our Buddha nature is compared to the open, expansive sky that is always there. Clouds may temporarily obscure it, but since the clouds and the sky are not of the same nature, the clouds can be removed. Similarly, the deeper nature of our mind is pure, but it is temporarily obscured by circumstantial defilements of the disturbing attitudes, negative emotions, and subtle stains. When these are eliminated through practicing the path, we become fully enlightened Buddhas. Why can't we remember our past lives? At the moment, our minds are obscured by ignorance, making it difficult to remember the past. Also, many changes occur in our body and mind as we die and are reborn, making recollection difficult. However, the fact that we don't remember something doesn't mean that it does not exist. Sometimes we cannot even remember where we put our car keys, nor can we remember what we ate for dinner a month ago. Some people can remember their past lives. The Tibetans have a system of recognizing the reincarnations of highly realized masters. Quite often, as young children, these people will recognize their friends or possessions from a previous life. Some ordinary people have also had past life recall, sometimes in meditation or through hypnosis. For example, as a child, a woman in Britain remembered the village in which she lived in her previous life and would draw pictures of it. She also recalled her family there. She was the mother of 8 children. When she was an adult, she went to that village and met her son from the previous life, who was now in his 70s. He was able to validate many of her previous life memories because he remembered the same events from his childhood. Is it important to know what our past lives were? No. What's important is how we live our present life. Knowing what we were in past lives is useful only if it helps us to generate strong determination to avoid negative actions or to free ourselves from cyclic existence. To try to find out who we were in past lives only for curiosity's sake isn't useful. It could even lead us to become proud. I was a king in my past life. I was so famous and talented. I was Einstein. So what? Actually, we have all been and done everything in our infinite past lives in cyclic existence. The important thing is to purify our previous negative actions, avoid creating more, and put energy into accumulating positive potential and developing our good qualities. There's a Tibetan saying, "If you want to know about your past life, look at your present body. If you want to know your future life, look at your present mind." We received our present rebirth as a result of our past actions. A human rebirth is a fortunate one, and we created the cause for it by living ethically in our previous lives. These good causes were probably created in a fortunate rebirth in the past, because creating such virtue is difficult in unfortunate rebirths. On the other hand, our future rebirths will be determined by what we think, say, and do now, and our mind motivates all these actions. Thus, we can get an idea of the kind of rebirths we will take by looking at our present attitudes and emotions and examining whether they are constructive or destructive. We don't need to go to a fortune teller to ask what will become of us. We can simply consider the imprints we are leaving on our mind stream, moment by moment, by our thoughts, words, and deeds. If everyone has had previous lives, how do you account for the population increase? All the people alive now weren't necessarily human beings on planet Earth in their past lives. Their previous lives could have been as another life form or in another universe. Earth is a tiny speck in the universe, and Buddhists believe that there is life in other places. Also, an animal, for example, could die and be reborn as a human. Chapter 8. Karma, the functioning of cause and effect. What is karma? How does it work? Karma means action, and refers to intentional physical, verbal, or mental actions. These actions leave imprints or seeds upon our mind streams, and the imprints ripen into our experiences when the appropriate conditions come together. For example, With a kind heart, we help someone. This action leaves an imprint on our mind stream. And when conditions are suitable, this imprint will ripen as our receiving help when we need it. If an action brings about pain and misery in the long term, it is called negative, destructive, or non-virtuous. If it brings about happiness, it is called positive, constructive, or virtuous. Actions aren't inherently good or bad, but are only designated so according to the results they bring. All results come from causes that have the ability to create them. If we plant apple seeds, an apple tree will grow, not chili. If chili seeds are planted, chili will grow, not apples. In the same way, if we act constructively, happiness will ensue. If we act destructively, problems will result. Whatever happiness and fortune we experience in our lives comes from our own positive actions, while our problems result from our own destructive actions. The seeds of our actions continue with us from one lifetime to the next and do not get lost. However, if we don't create the cause or karma for something, then we won't experience that result. If a farmer doesn't plant seeds, nothing will grow. Is the law of actions and their effects a system of punishment and reward? Did the Buddha create or invent it? Definitely not. According to Buddhism, there is no one in charge of the universe who distributes rewards and punishments. We create the causes by our actions, and we experience their results. We are responsible for our own experience. The Buddha didn't create the system of actions and their effects in the same way that Newton didn't invent gravity. Newton simply described what exists. Likewise, the Buddha described what he saw with his omniscient mind to be the natural process of cause and effect occurring within the mind stream of each being. By doing this, he showed us how best to work within the functioning of cause and effect in order to experience happiness and avoid pain. The misconception that happiness and pain are rewards and punishments may come from incorrect translations of Buddhist scriptures into English. I have seen some translations that use terminology from other religions. This is very misleading because terms such as heaven, hell, sin, punishment, and judgment do not correspond to Buddhist concepts. Appropriate English words that convey the meaning of the Buddha's teachings must be used. Does the law of actions and their effects apply only to people who believe in it? No. Cause and effect functions whether we believe in it or not. Positive actions produce happiness and destructive ones result in pain whether we believe they will or not. If a fruit drops from a tree, it falls down even if we believe it will go up. It would be wonderful if all we needed to do to avoid the results of our actions was to believe they wouldn't come. Then, for example, we could eat all we want and never get fat. People who don't believe in past lives and cause and effect still experience happiness as a result of their actions in past lives. But by denying the existence of cause and effect, and consequently not attempting to practice constructive actions and avoid destructive ones, they may create few positive potentials and recklessly create many negative ones. On the other hand, people who know about cause and effect will try to be mindful of what they think, say, and do to avoid hurting others and to avoid leaving harmful imprints on their own mind streams. What does karma affect? Karma can affect our future rebirths, that is, the kind of life form we will adopt. It also influences what we experience during our lives, how others treat us, our wealth, social status, and so forth. In addition, karma affects our personality and character, our talents, dominant personality traits, and habits. What kind of environment we're born into is also influenced by karma. Why do some people who act destructively appear to be successful and happy? Why do some people who don't believe in the functioning of cause and effect have good lives? When we see dishonest people who are wealthy, or cruel people who are powerful, or kind people who die young, we may doubt the law of actions and their effects. This is because we are looking only at the short period of this one life. Many of the results we experience in this life are the results of actions done in previous lives. And many of the actions we do in this life will ripen only in future lives. The wealth of dishonest people is the result of their generosity in preceding lives. Their current dishonesty leaves the karmic seed for them to be cheated and to experience poverty in future lives. Likewise, the respect and authority given to cruel people is due to positive actions they did in the past. In the present, they are misusing their power, thus creating the cause for future pain. Kind people who die young are experiencing the result of negative actions done in past lives. However, their present kindness is planting seeds or imprints on their mind streams for them to experience happiness in the future. The Buddhist scriptures outline general guidelines about the results of various actions. However, only a Buddha's omniscient mind can completely understand the specific details of the ripening of karma. For example, the scriptures tell us that killing causes a short life and generosity results in wealth. But we ordinary beings aren't capable of knowing for certain who our friend Susan was in a past life, to whom she was generous, and what she gave that resulted in her being rich in this life. There is flexibility in the functioning of actions and their results. While we know that insulting others, for example, brings an unfortunate rebirth, just exactly what body we're born into can vary. If the action was very heavy, for example, with strong anger, we repeatedly abused many people and afterward felt gratified that we had hurt their feelings, the result will be more unpleasant than if we casually teased someone once and later regretted our insensitivity. The conditions present at the time that karmic seed ripens will also influence what specific result it brings. Do we create karma together as a group? Yes. Karma may be either collective or individual. Collective karma are the actions we do together as a group. For example, soldiers use weapons, a group of religious practitioners pray or meditate. The results of these actions are experienced together as a group, often in future lives. Yet each member of a group thinks, speaks, and acts slightly differently, thus creating individual karma, the results of which each person will experience him or herself. Do we necessarily experience the results of all of our actions? When seeds, even small ones, are planted in the ground, they will eventually sprout. That is, unless they do not receive the necessary conditions for growth, such as water, sunshine, and fertilizer. Or they are burnt or pulled out of the ground. The ultimate way to uproot karmic imprints or seeds is by meditating on the emptiness of inherent existence. At our level, this may be rather difficult, but we can still stop the harmful seeds from ripening by purifying them. This is similar to preventing the seed from receiving water, sunshine, and fertilizer. How can we purify negative imprints? Purification by means of the four opponent powers is very important. It not only prevents future suffering, but also relieves guilt. By cleansing our minds, we will be more peaceful and will be able to concentrate and to understand the Dharma better. The four opponent powers used to purify negative imprints or seeds are 1. Regret 2. Determination not to do the action again 3. Taking refuge and generating an altruistic attitude toward others 4. An actual remedial practice. First, we acknowledge and regret that we have acted destructively. This is different from self-recrimination and guilt, which are useless and keep us bound up in anxiety. With sincere regret, on the other hand, we simply acknowledge our mistake and regret having made it. Secondly, we make a determination not to do the action again. If the action is habitual and frequent, for example, criticizing others, it would be hypocritical to say we will never do it again for the rest of our lives. It's better to resolve that we will try not to repeat the action again, but will be especially mindful and make a concerted effort during a realistic set period of time, such as a few days. In this way, we will also develop confidence that we can do what we promise to. The third opponent power is to take refuge and generate altruism. Our destructive actions are generally in relation to either holy entities, such as the Buddhas, Dharma, and Sangha, or other sentient beings. To reestablish a good relationship with the holy objects, we seek their guidance by taking refuge in them. To restore our good relationships with other sentient beings, we generate an altruistic attitude towards them by aspiring to become a Buddha so we can best benefit them. The fourth opponent power is remedial action. This may be any positive action: listening to teachings, reading a Dharma book, bowing to the three jewels, making offerings, reciting the names of the Buddhas, chanting mantras, making statues or paintings of the Buddhas, printing texts, meditating, and so on. We may also offer service in the community, aiding those in difficulty by doing volunteer work in schools, hospitals, or environmental organizations. Or we may offer service to a Dharma center or temple. The most powerful remedial action is to meditate on emptiness, because non-conceptual wisdom uproots the negative imprints so that they can never bear fruit. The four opponent powers must be done repeatedly. We have acted harmfully many times, so we cannot expect to counteract these seeds at once. The stronger the four opponents' powers are, the stronger our regret, the firmer our determination not to do the action again, and so on, the more powerful the purification will be. It's especially effective to purify ourselves using the four opponent powers every evening before going to sleep, to counteract any destructive actions we have done during the day. If people suffer because of their own negative actions, does that mean that we cannot or should not do anything to help them? Not at all. We know what it's like to feel miserable, and that is exactly how others feel when they are experiencing the results of their own destructive actions. Out of empathy and compassion, we should definitely help. Their present predicament was brought about by their own actions, but that doesn't mean that we should stand by and say, "Oh, that's too bad, you poor thing, you shouldn't have done such destructive actions." Karma isn't inflexible or cast in concrete. It doesn't mean fate or predetermination. People may have created the cause to experience difficulties, but they also may have created the cause to receive help from us. Even more than that, we all know how we would feel if we were in such a situation. We are all alike in wanting happiness and trying to avoid pain. It doesn't matter whose pain or problem it is. We must try to relieve it. For example, to think, "The poor are poor because of their own miserliness in past lives, I would be interfering with their karma if I tried to help," is a cruel misconception. We should not rationalize our own laziness, apathy, or smugness by misinterpreting cause and effect. Compassion and universal responsibility are important for our own spiritual development and for world peace. They are the cornerstones of all Buddhist practice. Does karma influence whom we will meet and the relationships we'll have with them? Yes. But this doesn't mean those relationships are predetermined. We may have certain karmic predispositions to feel close to or to have friction with certain people. Nevertheless, these relationships may not continue along those same lines. If we are kind to those who speak ill of us and try to communicate effectively with them, the relationships will change. We'll also create positive karma, which will bring happiness in the future. We are not karmically bound to others, nor are there soulmates, special people who are the one and only one for us. Since we've had infinite past lives, we've had contact with every being sometime before. Also, our relationship with any particular person constantly changes. Nonetheless, past karmic connections can influence our present relationships. For example, if someone has been our spiritual mentor in a past life, we may be drawn to that person this lifetime, and his or her teaching the Dharma may have a very strong effect on our minds. Can understanding karma help us to understand the events in our lives better? Yes, it can. The happiness we experience comes from our previously created positive actions. Understanding this encourages us to act constructively and not sit back passively when opportunities to be kind appear. When we experience some difficulties in life, we should reflect on the type of action we must have done that created the cause for this result. This will encourage us to be more aware of what we think, say, and do. Studying the Buddha's teachings enables us to learn more about specific actions and their results. Then we can change our behavior and plant more seeds in our mind streams to experience desirable results. A text called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons is particularly good in explaining the effects produced by certain actions and the way to change our attitudes and actions to create the cause of happiness. Can people be reborn as animals and animals as people? How is that karmically possible? Yes. Based on our actions, our minds are attracted toward certain types of rebirth when we die. It may seem difficult to imagine that a human being could be reborn as an animal, but if we consider the fact that some people act worse than animals, it doesn't seem so far-fetched. For example, animals kill only when they are threatened or hungry, while some human beings kill for sport, fame, or power. If someone's mind habitually goes in a certain direction, it makes sense that his or her body could correspond to that mental state in a future life. Similarly, animals can be reborn as humans. Although it's difficult for most animals to do many positive actions, it's hard to teach a dog to meditate or to offer community service, it is possible. For this reason, Tibetans take their animals when they circumambulate holy monuments in order to put good imprints on the animals' minds. Many people enjoy saying their prayers or mantras out loud so their pets can hear them and be exposed to such soothing sounds, even though the animals do not understand the meaning. Ordinary people have both positive and negative karmic imprints on their minds. What rebirth we take is not a sum total of all of our past karma. Rather, certain seeds ripen while others remain dormant. Thus, if someone is angry at the time he dies, some of the negative imprints could ripen and he could be reborn as a dog. However, the positive imprints still remain on his mind stream, and when causes and conditions come together, they could ripen, causing him to again be reborn as a human. Chapter 9. Dying, Death, and the Intermediate State. How can we best help someone who is dying or dead? When people are terminally ill, we should help them arrange their worldly affairs while their bodies and minds are still strong. In this way, they can put to rest their worries and concerns about money and family. It's helpful if they can give away their belongings because they create much good karma through generosity, and this will help them in future lives. Generosity also frees them from attachment, which is very harmful at the time of death. We should encourage them to resolve any grudges or remorse they may have, either by discussing their feelings with the people concerned or by doing purification practices. Apologizing, forgiving, and telling those they love that they love them can help to free their minds from anger and guilt and enable them to die peacefully. If we cannot help people prepare for death in this way, then as death approaches, we should assure them that their worldly affairs will be taken care of after they pass away. They need not be concerned about who will pay the bills or take care of the children. They should concentrate on leaving this life peacefully, without fears or worries. Don't bother people by asking, "Who will get your jewelry? Do you have any hidden money?" Or, "How will I live without you?" Our motivation is to help dying people, not to give them more problems. When people are dying, create an environment that is calm and free from people and things that could evoke their attachment or anger. Dying peacefully is difficult if the entire family is in the room crying, grasping the person's hand and pleading, "Please don't die. We love you. How can you leave us?" We may think we are expressing our love and concern by acting this way, but actually, our selfish mind is wailing because we're losing someone we care about. We should try to care more about the dying person's needs than our own, and make the environment calm and pleasant. During a person's final hours before death, it is recommended to discontinue all invasive treatment, monitors, IVs, and so on. This allows the person to turn his or her thoughts inward and prepare to die without being distracted by external commotion. It also permits the physical energies to dissolve in a more natural way. Dying with anger, attachment, jealousy, or pride as their last thought is harmful. Thus, we should try to create a quiet and calm environment and encourage them to generate positive thoughts. If they are Buddhist, we can talk about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and remind them of their spiritual masters. We should show them pictures of the Buddha or chant prayers and mantras in the room. Before death actually occurs, encourage them to purify their destructive actions. Tell them to pray for a good rebirth, to meet pure teachings and teachers, and to make their death, intermediate state, and rebirth beneficial for others. If people are of other faiths, do not push your faith on them at the time of death. That causes confusion in their minds. Rather, speak according to their faith and encourage them to generate positive states of mind. Are people reborn immediately after death? Or is there an intermediate state before the next rebirth? The heart and breath may stop and people may be brain dead, but their subtlest consciousness may still remain connected to the body for up to 3 days. Highly realized masters may even meditate for weeks after their vital signs have ceased, before their subtlest consciousness leaves their body. For that reason, it's recommended to leave the body undisturbed for several days, or at least for a few hours if possible. Then touch the crown of the person's head, because the consciousness leaving from that point is auspicious for the next life. After an ordinary person's mind leaves the gross physical body, it enters an intermediate stage, Bardo in Tibetan, before it assumes another gross body. Depending on conditions, a person may remain in the intermediate stage for only a few moments, or for as long as 49 days. In certain cases, the person is reborn immediately, without staying in the intermediate state. Although I've asked several teachers, I haven't discovered why the bardo must cease after 49 days, rather than another number of days. Beings in the intermediate state have subtle bodies that are not made of atoms, but are similar to the being they will become. For a short time, they may try to communicate with their friends or relatives from their previous life. But intermediate state beings are not able to communicate with human beings. After 49 days, they have definitely taken new bodies and are absorbed in the experiences of their new lives. Can someone be reborn as a spirit? How do we account for channeling or for people who talk to a dead relative through a medium? Some people have created the causes to be reborn as spirits. Spirits belong to a realm of life forms called hungry ghosts, which is considered an unfortunate rebirth. Spirits and sometimes gods can channel through mediums, but all these beings are still bound to cyclic existence by their ignorance, attachment, and anger. Some may have clairvoyant powers. Some may not. Some may tell the truth. Some may not. Spiritual channeling is not always reliable. There's no need to contact dead friends and relatives. It's more worthwhile to communicate well with them and be kind to them now, while they're alive. Does chanting for the dead help? What else can be done for them? After death, chanting the sutras and doing other Buddhist practices can be helpful by stimulating the deceased's own positive potential to ripen. Although they have already left their physical body and can't hear the chanting with their ears, our creating positive potential and dedicating it to their welfare can help. Traditionally, such virtuous practices are done each week for 7 weeks after a death. Until they find another gross body to take rebirth in, they remain in the intermediate stage. The positive potential we create and dedicate for them can help them find a good rebirth. However, don't think, "I'll ask some monks and nuns to do the chanting while I go about my business." We have a karmic relationship with the deceased, so the prayers and virtuous activities that we dedicate for their benefit are important too. It's helpful to offer the deceased's possessions to others as a way of practicing generosity and accumulating positive potential. Offering to holy objects, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and to the poor and sick is especially beneficial. We can then dedicate the positive potential from this for the benefit of all sentient beings, and especially for the deceased. Some Asians leave out food for the deceased and burn paper money and houses for the deceased. Is this necessary or beneficial? It's said that intermediate state beings survive by eating smells, so leaving out food may be helpful during the 49 days after death. After that, the deceased have been reborn in a happy or unfortunate rebirth according to their previous actions. After they have been born, the food set out never reaches them. Most likely, there is food available wherever they have been reborn. However, we can offer food to beings born as hungry ghosts, be they our former relatives and friends or not, by reciting certain mantras over extra food. These mantras help to eliminate the hungry ghost's karmic obscurations to finding food. Burning paper cars, clothes, or money doesn't give the deceased these things in their future rebirth. The tradition of doing so is an old Chinese custom, not a practice taught by the Buddha. If we want to help our relatives and friends to have wealth in their future lives, we should encourage them to make offerings and be generous while they are alive. The Buddha said generosity, not burning paper objects, is the cause of wealth. Sometimes we may advise our relatives, don't give away so much. Our family won't have as much money if you do. By encouraging them to be miserly, we cause them to plant seeds in their mind streams to be poor in their future lives. Also, we plant the same kind of seeds in our own mind streams. On the other hand, encouraging them to be generous and to avoid cheating others in business helps them to be wealthy in the future. If we want our loved ones to have a good rebirth, the best help we can give is to encourage them while they are alive to avoid the 10 destructive actions and to practice the 10 constructive ones, which are their opposites. The 10 destructive actions are killing, stealing, unwise sexual behavior, lying, slander, harsh speech, gossip, coveting others' possessions, maliciousness, and wrong views. If we encourage them to lie to protect us or to cheat someone so we can have more money, we're helping them to create the cause for unfortunate rebirths. Should we spend hours gossiping with them, drinking, and criticizing others, we're defeating our own purpose. Since we sincerely want our relatives and friends to be happy after death, we should help them abandon these destructive actions and practice constructive ones. We can encourage, but not force them to take ethical precepts. That is really acting to benefit their future lives. What is the Buddhist view on suicide? Suicide is considered a great tragedy. Human life is precious, and it's a tragedy when people become so overwhelmed by their disturbing attitudes that they see death as the only way to stop their suffering. In fact, suicide doesn't really solve their problems because they will be reborn. Also, people who kill themselves are generally experiencing great anger, jealousy, or other disturbing attitudes at the time of death, and this could adversely affect their future rebirth. Buddhists believe that all sentient beings have the Buddha potential, or Buddha nature, the potential to become fully enlightened. The disturbing attitudes are like clouds obscuring the pure nature of our minds, but they aren't part of us. They are fleeting, and through Dharma practice, we can remove them entirely. If people could get even an inkling of this, they wouldn't take their own misery so seriously and would be confident in their own inner goodness. This new perspective may help them decide to continue living because they recognize a reliable way to stop their problems. What is the Buddhist view on euthanasia? From the Buddhist viewpoint, preserving life is generally recommended. However, each situation is different and must be looked at individually. In many cases, there are no easy answers. If we know that a person who is comatose or who is in great pain will be reborn in a happier situation, then, motivated by compassion, we could consider mercy killing. However, as most of us lack such clairvoyance, it's extremely difficult to know whether we would be helping or harming another by mercy killing. The seed of a previous negative action could possibly ripen, causing that person to be reborn in a situation which is worse than the present one. Sometimes people come out of coma and live for many years. If people understand the value of human life, how precious it is for practicing the path to enlightenment, they may be able to transform painful situations into the path. For example, people may be bedridden, but if their minds are alert, they can practice the Dharma, increase their good qualities, purify their negative actions, and practice the path to enlightenment. In fact, they may have more time to do this than people who are busy running here and there. Some Buddhist practices are especially designed for transforming adverse conditions into the path, and we teach them to people who are very ill. Also, I have spoken to people who have been in comas, and several of them said that they were aware of their environment. Thus, reading prayers or reciting mantras near comatose people could help them. Even if their minds are obscured, hearing the Dharma leaves beneficial imprints on their minds. When people make living wills, stating their preferences for medical treatment if they are severely injured or ill, it reduces their family's anxiety should such unfortunate events occur. Not putting someone on life support when there is no hope for his or her recovery is not an act of killing. This is simply letting nature take its course, and it may allow the person to die more peacefully than if invasive or forceful measures were employed. However, once someone is on a life support system, the issue becomes more complicated. Each situation needs to be considered separately because many factors are involved. The dying person's own wishes, the severity of their condition, the person's level of conscious awareness, his or her spiritual preparedness for death and emotional state, and the emotional and financial toll on the family. There is no one answer suitable for all cases. We must act with as much compassion and wisdom as possible when faced with such difficult decisions. Because funding for medical research and health care is limited, our society could allocate most of those funds to improve prenatal care and education, thus improving the quality of life. In this way, people would not be faced with so many ethical and emotional dilemmas near the time of death. Chapter 10. The Buddhist Traditions. What are the Buddhist scriptures called? The scriptures spoken by the Buddha fall into two general categories, the sutras and the tantras. The sutras deal with the higher trainings of ethical discipline, meditative stabilization, and wisdom, as well as the development of altruism and the general practices undertaken with that motivation. The tantras describe practices unique to Vajrayana. The Buddha spoke both the sutras and tantras during his lifetime, but to different audiences. His direct disciples memorized them, and later generations recorded them in writing. Why are there many Buddhist traditions? The Buddha gave a wide variety of teachings because sentient beings, beings with mind, who are not yet Buddhas, have different dispositions, inclinations, and interests. The Buddha never expected everyone to fit into the same mold. Thus, with skill and compassion in guiding others, he offered several philosophical systems and ways of practicing so that each of us could find something that suits our inclinations and personality. The essence of all his teachings is the same: the determination to be free from cyclic existence, love, compassion, and altruism toward others, and the wisdom realizing reality. Not everyone likes the same kind of food. At a huge buffet dinner, we can choose the dishes we like. Although we may have a taste for sweets, that doesn't mean that the salty dishes aren't good and should be thrown away. Similarly, we may prefer a certain approach to the teachings. Theravada, Pure Land, Zen, Vajrayana, and so on. We are free to choose the approach that suits us best and with which we feel the most comfortable. However, maintaining an open mind and respect for other traditions is important. As our minds develop, we may come to understand elements in other traditions that we failed to comprehend previously. In short, we should practice whatever we find useful to help us live a better life, and we can leave aside without criticizing whatever we do not yet understand. Although we may find one particular tradition best suited for our personality, it's not wise to identify with it too strongly. I am a Mahayanist. You are a Theravadin. Or, I am a Buddhist. You are a Christian. We are all human beings who seek happiness and want to realize the truth, and we each must find a method that suits our disposition. However, while keeping an open mind to different approaches, we should avoid mixing everything together at random, making our practice like chop suey. It's best not to do meditation techniques from different traditions together in one meditation session, but in each session to stick to the techniques taught in one tradition. If we take a little of this technique and a little from that and mix them together without understanding either one very well, we may end up confused. Nevertheless, a teaching emphasized in one tradition may enrich our understanding and practice of another. In addition, it is advisable to do the same meditation daily. If we do breathing meditation one day, chanting the Buddha's name the next, and analytical meditation the third, we won't make progress in any of them, for we lack continuity in practice. However, we can do all three each day, thus maintaining continuity in our practice. What are the various Buddhist traditions? Generally, there are two divisions, Theravada and Mahayana. The Theravada lineage, tradition of the elders, which relies on sutras recorded in the Pali language, spread from India to Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, and other Southeast Asian countries. It emphasizes meditation on the breath to develop concentration, and meditation on mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, in order to develop wisdom. In Pali, these two types of meditation are called shamatha and vipassana. The Mahayana, great vehicle, tradition, based on the scriptures recorded in Sanskrit, spread to China, Tibet, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. Although love and compassion are essential and important factors in Theravada Buddhism, they are emphasized to an even greater extent in Mahayana Buddhism. Within Mahayana, there are several branches. Pure Land emphasizes chanting the name of Amitabha Buddha in order to be reborn in his pure land, a place where all conditions are conducive to Dharma practice. Zen, Chan, emphasizes meditation to eliminate the noisy conceptual mind. Vajrayana, diamond vehicle, employs meditation on a deity in order to transform our contaminated body and mind into those of a Buddha. These are just a few examples of the many schools in Mahayana. The fact that there are a variety of practices within the Buddhist doctrine attests to the Buddha's skill in guiding people according to their dispositions and needs. It is extremely important not to be partial and sectarian, but to have respect for all the traditions and their practitioners. Since the teaching of all these traditions originate from the Buddha, if we disparage one tradition, we are disparaging the Buddha and his teachings. Why do some monks and nuns wear saffron robes, while others dress in maroon, gray, or black? As the Buddhist teachings spread from one country to another, they adapted to the culture and mentality of the people in each place without changing the essential meaning. The style of the Sangha's robes is an external form, not the actual internal meaning of the teaching. Thus it may change. In Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, and Laos, for example, the robes are various shades of saffron and do not have sleeves. The climate and culture in those countries enabled them to retain the color and design of the robes from the Buddha's time. People who have taken the eight precepts and aren't technically monks or nuns wear white robes. Saffron dye wasn't available in Tibet, so a deeper color, maroon, was used. In China, it was considered impolite to expose the skin, so the long-sleeved costume of the Tang Dynasty was adopted. Also, the Chinese considered saffron too bright for those on a religious path, and only the emperor was permitted to wear golden-colored clothes. Thus, in China, the color of the robes was changed to gray or black. However, the spirit of the original robes was kept in the form of the 5, 7, and 9-piece brown, yellow, and red outer robes that the monks and nuns wear while praying. Why do the rituals differ from one tradition to the next? Chanting styles vary in the various Buddhist countries in correspondence to the culture and language of the place. The musical instruments and the way of bowing differ as well. For example, the Chinese stand up while chanting, while the Tibetans sit down. These variations are due to cultural adaptations. Similarly, the internal design of the temples may vary according to the place. Generally, temples have a statue of Shakyamuni Buddha in the center, and according to the tradition, other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, and Dharma protectors may also be depicted. The Tibetan environment was very stark, so they liked their temples to be very colorful and elaborately decorated inside. On the other hand, the Japanese landscape is lush, so they preferred the interiors of the temples to be simpler. The external forms and ways of doing things are not the Dharma. They are tools to help us practice the Dharma better, according to the culture and place in which we live. The real Dharma can't be seen with our eyes or heard with our ears. It is to be experienced by our minds and hearts. We must direct our attention to the real Dharma, not to the superficial appearances that may vary from place to place. Chapter 11. Vajrayana. What is Vajrayana? What are the special qualities of Vajrayana practice? Based upon the Theravada and general Mahayana practices, Vajrayana, also called Tantrayana, is a subdivision of the Mahayana. Vajrayana is widespread in Tibet and is practiced by the Japanese Shingon tradition as well. One technique used in Vajrayana is visualizing oneself as a deity, and the environment as the mandala, or the environment of the deity. Using imagination in this way, Vajrayana practitioners transform their ordinary, poor self-image into that of a fully enlightened Buddha, and thus try to cultivate the noble qualities of the Buddhas in their own mind streams. In other words, rather than getting locked into ordinary feelings of low self-esteem and lack of confidence, they imagine what it would feel like to be impartially compassionate toward all beings and to perceive the empty nature of all phenomena. Doing this functions psychologically to give them the energy and ability to progress along the path and actually develop those qualities. Vajrayana contains techniques for transforming death, the intermediate state, and rebirth into the body and mind of a Buddha. It also has special meditative techniques to develop calm abiding, samatha, as well as to make manifest an extremely subtle mind, which is used to realize emptiness. This extremely subtle wisdom mind can quickly and powerfully cleanse defilements from the mind stream. For this reason, Vajrayana can bring enlightenment in this very lifetime if one is a qualified and well-trained student who practices under the guidance of a fully qualified tantric master. Buddhist Tantra is not the same as Hindu Tantra, nor is it the practice of magic. Some people have written books about Vajrayana with incorrect information and interpretations. Therefore, if we wish to learn about this practice,